6. Some people were awestruck by Jedi, unable to relate to them. Others could be hostile, afraid of what they didn't understand, afraid of power they couldn't possess. Sheltered as he'd been within the temple, Wreath often wasn't sure how to bridge the gap and connect with regular people as, well, people. With Nan, there was no gap at all.
Are the Jedi soldiers sworn to the Republic?
She glanced down shyly as they stood beneath the canopy of leaves that sheltered the station docks.
Or do you fight only for yourselves?
Wreath shook his head.
Neither. I mean, we defend the Republic, but we work with them, not for them. And that's not all we do. We try to help and protect all those in need when we can.
This didn't seem to make sense to Nan.
Do you accept payment?
We're not mercenaries. He had to laugh. Is it so unimaginable that a group of people might try to do the right thing just because it is the right thing?
It is around here,
she said, her expression grim. Despite her youth, Nan had evidently witnessed some terrible things.
What's that at your belt? Is it the sword we've heard of? The fire saber?
He grinned. It's called a lightsaber, and yeah, this one's mine.
Will you light it?
Nan asked, anticipation sparkling in her dark eyes. Not unless I have a good reason. It wasn't forbidden, but if he did that, he'd draw too much attention. Master Comac might even think they were flirting. Actually, Wreath thought Nan probably was flirting, but he was just explaining.
Please?
Nan's expression could have melted ice.
I'd love to know how it works.
Before Wreath could figure out how vulnerable he might be to that expression, Leox's voice came over the comms.
The final ships are boarding all passengers to the station. You guys ready out there?
Absolutely, Wreath said. The moment was broken. He could focus on his duty again.
Come on, Nan. Let's greet the guests.
She made a face.
Mizzy? Or Inkens? You can call them whatever you want, but they're not going to act like guests.
What will they act like?
Wreath asked. Nan had a mischievous smile.
Wait and see.
Good thing the bracing joints held on this station,
thought Affy Hollow as she made her way along the walkway through a tangle of vines.
Otherwise, this thing would have imploded, and who knows where we'd have wound up.
Somewhere else, pre-programmed into the computer, some other locations Scover had downloaded, not knowing what traps might have been set for her in old Navicomputers. Affy had chosen to wander upward, along the lone spiral walkway that traveled along the central globe of the Amaxine Station, leading toward the topmost rings. From her vantage point, she could survey the layout almost completely. Outer ring, several metal arches separating the various segments, each of which had an airlock of its own. Central sphere, several enclosures set up along the walkway, but otherwise completely an arboretum. She would have thought it was always intended to be one if it weren't for the fact that the Amaxines had built this. The legends suggested they weren't the tranquil gardener type. Through the transparent plates, she could see some of the other ships coming in to dock.
They put the Arinkan ship next to the Mizzy? Oh, that's going to be a huge mess.
These Jedi might be brilliant monk wizards, but they were also completely uninformed about this part of the galaxy, especially which species within it hated each other. As she passed the one large irregular airlock in the sphere, Affy was tempted to head back to the bridge to help Leox and Geode sort through the resulting squabbles, and to witness the poleaxed expressions on the Jedi's faces. She didn't dislike any of the Republic types, actually, but it was very obvious how much they thought they were the ones bringing wisdom and knowledge. About time they learned better. But while plenty of the ships would be crewed by beings that loathed each other, none of them seemed likely to make war. It would be a mess, not a disaster. Probably. so that meant Affy was free to explore on her own. Lower rings? She still didn't know. Upper rings? Affy looked up. By then, she was within meters of the tunnel that would lead up and out. Time to discover just what else this station had to offer. From one corridor, she heard Orla Jareni and Comac Vitus saying something indistinct, no doubt about the antiquities that seemed to practically litter the decks. They'd be distracted by that for a while and would pay no attention to where Affy went or what she did. This was ideal. She pushed aside a curtain of vines and made her way into the tunnel that led upward. Gravity adjusted with her as she went, an unusual and ingenious modification. Apparently, all those ancient station mechanisms remained in perfect working order. Affy had no intention of touching anything inside, because any tech so old that was still running would be best left alone. Any other space traveler would know that too. Other space travelers would also know that the top and bottom rings were the likeliest places for storage bays, and for the cargo others had left behind. If she was any judge, this station's storage was at the top. Sure enough, as Affy stepped from the tunnel into the shadowy topmost rings, she could make out long lines of storage bays, some locker-sized, some bigger, stretching into the central dark. Larger storage might be located on the lower rings. The larger bays could hold potentially dangerous substances, so she'd go through those later, maybe with Leox's help. For now, she would just rummage around. Then she cocked her head. Was there writing on the lockers? Affy turned on her glow rod as she crept forward. Across the lockers and other bay doors were scrawled some symbols, not labeling but actual handwriting or painting, with the same kind of grease pencil pilots used to mark wires for repair. Affy had never handwritten anything in her life, which was hardly unique. Probably she'd never even met someone who wrote something down. Nor was this writing Orabesh. It was symbols, little pictures instead of letters. Different lines were written at different heights, in different styles. Then she spotted at the very ends of the lines, much smaller numbers. Dates, Affy realized. Those are dates that tells us when they were here. As she'd suspected, it hadn't been that long before. One line was from just 6 years back. Another was from earlier, but still only about 32 years prior. All the writing seemed to come from the recent era, a very long time after this station would have been abandoned. There was no making sense of the lines without knowing their language, or, more likely, their code. The pictographs were fairly crude. Affy ran one finger beneath a line drawing of a crested wave with a diagonal streak through it that looked like the readouts that indicated a gravitational disturbance. And there was one shaped like a Y that suggested a potential fork in the hyperspace lanes or some other diversion. She began to smile as she realized that this was a place where wayfarers left messages for each other, warnings about the path ahead. But why leave important messages in code? Why not make them easy for everyone to read? Affy kept picking out new symbols, trying to guess what each might mean, trailing her finger beneath each line. Then her finger came to a stop, and her smile faded. This symbol was a four-pointed star, a distinctive, stylized one, a symbol Affy knew by heart, which was fitting because she wore it over her heart every day she wore her uniform coverall. It was the crest of the Bind Guild.
It's muggy in here, Orla said. Almost steamy. Gotta give the biome credit. The best-seeded arboretums rarely last anything close to this long. This one not only survived, it's got humidity.
Lucky us, Comac said wryly.
They stood in the central sphere within what Orla could see had been a kind of ceremonial area, one marked with a stone-carved seat, or perhaps a throne. A total of 4 statues stood guard. Each one depicted a different species or perhaps mythological figure, but they all shared the golden plating and the richly jeweled ornamentation. Vines slithered along the nearby trees and archways, not literally, though the constant rustling encouraged that illusion. The light was dappled with the shadows of leaves. Those shadows played on Comac's face as he stepped closer to one of the statues, peering up at the finely carved wings and carapace.
"Do you recognize it?"
Orla asked. Comac shook his head.
"The style of carving is not unlike the ancient Kumas, but that system is so distant, my first assumption would be that the similarity is a coincidence. Furthermore, the Kumas don't have any insect gods, so far as I know."
Orla put her hands on her hips.
"Maybe they're not gods. Maybe they're monarchs or historical leaders."
"Monarchs, perhaps," Comac said. "But I doubt they're historical figures. The way they're elevated over the viewers, the grandiose halos over their heads. See, there are spaces that probably held even larger jewels once upon a time. To me, that suggests profound reverence, the deepest respect and adoration. In the long run, history isn't that kind to anybody, but religions are. Myths are. There could be other meanings, too. Until we translate this language, I can't offer anything more than an educated guess. Gods would be my bet."
A soft breeze tugged at the edge of Comac's robes, played across Orla's cheek. At first, Orla simply welcomed that faint touch of coolness. Then she thought,
"Guess that's why the vines are rustling. This station has even better ventilation than I'd realized."
Then Orla felt a delicate shiver of unease, an eerie sensation that only grew with each moment. Comac turned to her.
"There it is, the shadow, the darkness."
They stood still for a few moments.
"We've all felt it now," Orla said. "I might have assumed it was no more than a rogue tree. Plants can sometimes be strong in the dark side. But this..."
"It's different,"
Comac finished for her.
"It feels deliberate."
Orla breathed in and out, tried to center herself in the force, but such calm was elusive. By then, the darkness was more than a shiver, almost a presence, as if something or someone was slowly approaching them. Orla wondered if that could be true. Had a being hidden on this station? Was it not as abandoned as they had supposed?
"I'm checking the corridor,"
Orla said, hurrying toward the door. From the corner of her eye, she saw Comac nodding. He'd sensed the same thing. And then Orla was alone in the howling dark. She dropped into a crouch before the gale force winds could knock her down. Cold chilled her to the marrow, and sharp flecks of debris scratched at her skin. Terror clawed at her belly, threatening to drag her into darkness too. Orla called on the Force to sustain her. Even if she could no longer sense it, the Force was always there.
"Comac!"
she shouted, not knowing why.
"Comac! Where are you?"
Shards of metal and mineral dug into her hands as she pushed herself up, trying to look around. In the distance, she could make out only collapsed beams of metal, and through them an ominous glow. Though it was the brightest light she could see, it filled her with nothing but horror. No more cold. No more darkness. Orla opened her eyes. When had she closed them? To find herself in the Arboretum, near the door, just where she'd been a few seconds before when the universe made sense.
"Comac!"
she called, but heard no answer. Rising back to her feet, she saw him lying among the moss and vines on the floor, either unconscious or in trance, as though prostrate before an unknown god. Orla hurried to his side, and just as she knelt by Comac's shoulder, his dark eyes flew open. But his breaths were coming short and shallow, and he stared upward at Orla without seeming to truly see.
"We have to get back to the ship,"
Orla said gently, unsure whether Comac could even hear her.
"Let me put my arm beneath your shoulders,"
That wasn't just a vision.
Komak blinked, then looked up at Orla with complete clarity.
It was a warning.
Reef had thought they were getting to the easy part. Everybody was safe. Everybody needed to share space for a while, so they'd all try to get along, right? He'd been so wrong. The first pilots to emerge were humans who looked rough and wanted you to know it.
"This place is abandoned, huh?"
one of them said, stalking right past Reef's hand outstretched in welcome.
"That makes everything on board fair game."
"Wait," Reef began. "Everyone should get a chance at the resources they need."
"Not if they're mine."
The guy tugged at the red kerchief around his neck as he smirked at Reef.
"Anything that's not bolted down is mine. Anything I can pull loose isn't bolted down. Come on, men, let's start hunting."
They stalked through the rings, looking for lockers and other storage. Before Reef could decide whether to go after them, another group emerged. These were the Arinkans, who appeared to be related to the Gamorreans, only paler and less photogenic. Their captain squealed in outrage at the sight of the humans already plundering the ring, then took off after them. Reef first went for his comlink.
"Master Komak, we're dealing with some unrest among the refugees. If you could come, that would be a big help."
No answer came. Reef drew on the force, summoned his will, and called out,
"You want to stop looting the station and return to this place?"
Nobody listened. He breathed out in frustration. Master Jorah was so good at bending people's will with the force, but it was more an innate skill than one easily taught. Reef might get the knack of it someday, but that wouldn't do any good in the here and now. Reluctantly, Reef pulled out his lightsaber. Time to lay down the law, which he'd never laid down before, but he'd figure it out.